You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Spectrum Business works with small businesses nationwide, so we know that running your own business means doing it all. Marketing, sales, inventory, customer service, and more. Spectrum One for Business helps you keep it all connected for just $49.99 a month. Get fast, reliable internet, advanced Wi-Fi with security shield, and a free mobile line for one low price. Stay connected and do it all with Spectrum One for Business. Only $49.99 a month. Go to spectrum.com/business to learn more. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up. The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Listen closely. That's not just paint rolling on a wall. It's artistry. A master painter carefully applying Benjamin Moore Regal Select Eggshell with deftly executed strokes. The roller, lightly cradled in his hands, applying just the right amount of paint. It's like hearing poetry in motion. Benjamin Moore, see the love.
Hi, my name is Tanya Pinkins, and I'm the host of the podcast You Can't Say That on the Broadway Podcast Network. This fall, I have a special treat for you. In honor of my debut feature film, Red Pill, Marissa Lynn Daniels Studio has been hosting weekly conversations with my fellow Broadway colleagues and co-host Sierra Renee about the red pilling of America. These conversations create a safe space for us to talk about the things that are on our mind with an election and a global pandemic. So join us for The Red Pilling of America, a spotlight series, every Saturday at 5 p.m. or on the Broadway Podcast Network, You Can't Say That, bpn.fm/YCST. Join the conversation.
Yes. Hello, Brad Pitt.
Brad Pitt.
Love you, man. Brad Pitt's here.
Oh my God, I'm so excited.
It just happens with the names, you know.
Well, hello, everyone. Are we good, Marissa?
We're just waiting for two more to clear in, but I hit admit all. So we should be
okay.
Joining in shortly.
Yeah. Okay, great. Well, I just want to say thank you all to everyone who's here. We're very grateful for you guys for joining us on this next. Oh, here we go. We got some new people coming in. Conversation. We're here to talk about Tanya Pinkins' new sociopolitical horror film, which she's mentioned several times now, you know, when she first wrote it. People would read it and go, oh, this sounds crazy. And now it sounds just like reality. So here we are in 2020 in a very strange time. So Tanya Pinkins, as you may or may not know, is the winner of all of the awards, including a Tony, a Drama Desk, Clarence Derwin, Obie, Monarch, Lucille Lortel, LA Drama Critics Circle, Audience Choice Award, and so many more nominations. She's got she's an outspoken activist. She's writing and creating and producing and currently editing this film. She's got a podcast, You Can't Say That, on the Broadway Podcast Network. She does all the things. So if you don't know, you ought to know. Now you know. Now you know, okay? And we are so grateful to have her here and your wealth of knowledge. Thank you, Tanya, for all that you do. And then, of course, this week we have the amazing Telly Leung and John Rua. So Telly Leung is a TV and stage actor You may know him from Glee, Instinct, Law and Order, Godspell, Aladdin, In Transit, Wicked, Rent, Allegiance. And now he's even producing a new Christmas musical, which we'll talk to him about in a second. And then we've also got John Rua from Hamilton, In the Heights, Hands on a Hard Body, SpongeBob SquarePants. Have you guys heard of Hamilton? Did you like Hamilton? No, I'm just kidding. He's also an incredible, incredible, like, just dancer, choreographer. He actually choreographed a show that I did at the Muni, Jesus Christ Superstar, as well as Aida. And he just recently choreographed for Fish at the Garden. Whoa, huge stuff. And also West Side Story at Milwaukee Rep. And now he's actually been commissioned by Milwaukee Rep to create his own show. So we've got multi-talented artists and just an interesting panel of people here. We're very diverse and I love it, which is also a big point about Tanya's film. Tanya, you're always talking about that you want to...
But we yes. have to, I have to introduce Sierra Renee.
Oh, stop.
Hosting the spotlight every week, these wonderful conversations. Mm-hmm. Sierra is an incredible singer. She's also a filmmaker. She was most recently on Broadway in Frozen. I'm not going to remember the name of your character, but you're a superhero on The Flash and Arrow and Guardians of the...
Legends of Tomorrow.
Legends of Tomorrow. See, I don't have my superheroes down.
Sorry, it's all good. It's all good.
I've been tearing it up on TikTok, doing duets. she sings her ass off. I also had the pleasure of seeing her in The Hunchback of Notre Dame, and she's just a multi-hyphenate, incredibly talented woman who has been kind enough to co-host these talks in support of my film Red Pill, which is all about what's going on in America. And you know, you gotta laugh no matter what's going on in life. So this is a horror film and we gotta laugh. And who was it that said that history repeats itself first as a tragedy and then as a farce? I think we got all of that going on right now. So yes, Sierra, what are we talking about this week?
Well, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the diversity of characters in your story. So essentially, actually give everybody the log line and then we'll bounce off from there.
Log line of Red Pill is that it's the weekend of the 2020 election and a group of progressives ride into Red Country armed with heart, humor, and naivete. They should have brought heavy artillery.
Ooh, man, what's going to happen?
What's going to happen when the Proud Boys hit the polls to do their poll watching on November 3rd?
Yes, that is a big question. And honestly, it's not really a new question here in America. We've seen this many, 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 many times. So the characters in your piece, I think what I'm really interested in, and I can't wait to see, you said that you like to make, tell stories that represent the world that you actually live in, right? It's not just, you know, a bunch of white people or a bunch of black people or a bunch of whatever. You like try to bring in different ethnicities, different socioeconomic, all sorts of things. So can you tell us a little bit about kind of the variation and the characters and the diversity that you have in this piece?
Well, you know, I know that I'm a kind of person that I like all kinds of people. And often when I get my own friends together, they wonder how I'm friends with each of them because everybody imagines me to be a certain kind of person because I'm their friend. And when they see the other kinds of people that I hang out with, it's like, huh, well, where, how did you guys meet? So Ruben Blades, international recording artist, he's covering the Latino indigenous community and representing that perspective in this story about the fight for freedom and equality and democracy. Luba Mason, who is Ruben's wife in real life, she is representing the immigrant population in America. Jake O'Flaherty, good Irishman, is representing the Jewish population and the white male patriarchal population in America. Adeshalo Osakalumi, choreographer, actor from Fela, he is representing the Afro-Caribbean British population. my character is, of course, the African-American woman. And then Catherine Irby from Law and Order Criminal Intent is representing the white American version. And then we have a lot of other, Catherine Curtin is in it and Colby Minifee. But, you know, issues of, you know, what side of the wall are you from? Muslim perspectives, transgender perspectives are brought up. And I found in telling this story, depending on who's viewing the cut of the film, what people think is unimportant is so centered around, you know, people's thoughts revolve primarily around themselves. So I find that when people give me notes on the cut, it usually tells me more about them than it tells me about the movie that I've written.
Interesting. Interesting. Yeah. We talked a lot about that, like the audience, you know, so did you write this piece with a specific audience in mind, people that you were trying to reach? And has that shifted?
I really wrote it so people could have fun. I like to be scared and I like to laugh. So how could I talk about the political world we live in right now and have it be funny and scary and just a really fun ride? And then, you know, you always want anything you make to be something that people will go back to and watch more than once, so that the first time through, you could just have a really fun ride. But then if you watched it the next time, you'd be like, I didn't know that there was that level and that level. I mean, there's a lot of political history in it. There's a lot of metaphor symbolism about cults, about some of the founding things of America. But you don't have to get that on the first time, but it's all there. So obviously my first audience is the Black woman. I've never seen this particular Black woman perspective in a film. And I play a character named Cassandra. And in mythology, Cassandra is the character, is the woman who was doomed to tell the truth and never be believed. And so that is what happens in Red Pill. Cassandra is clear that they are in danger and they need to get out. This is the Black woman. And nobody believes her. And it didn't work out too well for them or for all of us as well.
I always thought that was one of the funniest parts of like scary movies. It's like the trope that like the Black person dies first. And you're like, but I feel like they're the ones that are like, actually, we should go. Like, I'm gonna go now, actually. I was always confused by that.
Did you guys see Halloween, the last one with the new one that was last year, John Telly? Did you guys see that Halloween?
Yes.
The best part for me was the little Black boy who was like, there's something in my room. And the babysitter's like, let me look. And he's like, no, send him. I'm going to get help.
That
was the best part of it all.
Yes.
Okay, so I want to dive in with John and Telly. I'm really interested to start kind of talking about just being different, feeling othered in this, in our society, especially in a time such as this, when we have an administration that seems to sort of base everything that they do on making everyone feel other or divided from someone else. So I know we had spoken about in our call earlier just about immigration and how that factors into who you are and your identity and your family and community and what that what it kind of means to be an American for you. So, John, can you kind of take it away?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. When I think about the feeling of being other, the first thought that comes to my mind is, it's not, I can't tangibly give you examples because fortunate, and this is weird to say, fortunately, I'm white passing. So because I'm white passing, I don't suffer the consequences and repercussions that others would not. And yet the lifestyle with which I lived has not felt as one of white passing because it's from a socioeconomic economic background. It's from the issues that I feel as if I've inherited inferiority. I feel as if the anxieties and the traumas that my parents have lived and come through, because very much immigrated, permeate through their existence and their lifestyles and their way of being. Very isolated existence in the country since none of my family's here. They're all in Colombia. There's an occasional person here and there, but even then we're so independent because of how we came up. I mean, my mom had 13 or 15 brothers and sisters. My dad had 22. I don't know. Yeah. And so I grew up here very isolated, and the Colombian community is scarce. It's, I mean, if I would grow up in a Miami, maybe it'd be a little different, but I'm not. I feel othered in this situation that there, I felt very alone, very isolated, no one to relate to. So immediately I related to the more impoverished background, to sort of a socioeconomic class. And in that, not being Colombian enough and still not being American enough, especially what's delivered to you by the identification of America. So whatever we grab, which is commercialism, very high, high commercialism, does not permeate or display me. I sometimes joke around and wonder, what would life be like if Selena never got murdered? If Selena kept living, would Mexican identity be completely different in the United States of America? Would music sound more like cumbia? Would things be completely different because they would have commercialized it? That being said, I also feel othered in a way that the representation of Latino, Latinx to America is not me. And so I'm othered simply for not being representative of how they identify me in my career.
Mm-hmm.
And also just in life, I'll walk around and someone will not believe that I'm of Latino origin. So it's, and yet I'm the one that speaks Spanish.
Yeah.
The funniest part about it is I'm the one that actually fluent. Yeah.
I feel you so hard on that. And just the idea of representation is so important. And I think like shifts in our industry they're being made, right? But they're also, the decisions about how the shifts are being made by the same people who have the problem in the first place. And so it's like really interesting because I have absolutely zero Latin in me at all. Mm-hmm. And yet every time I walk down the street, I have more people speaking Spanish to me than not. People are confused when I tell them that I have no Latin like heritage whatsoever. And it's also become right. And it's also become this thing in, you know, the entertainment industry. It's like, so I am seen a certain way by the people at the top, right? Generally white males. I am seen as Latin, and I've actually played Latin roles before. I do not get seen as a Black woman. So when I go in for Black woman roles, they're like, no. And then I can't go in for Latin anymore because literally I did my DNA test and I have none of it in. So it's like, I don't want to lie, you know, but we've gotten to this place where we're overcorrecting a little bit. And also everything's sort of based on the factual accuracy of whether or not you're Latin. And I'm like, I feel that because there have definitely been times where they're like, this character, it's so important that she like understand that being from Colombia or being from wherever. And I'm like,
right.
Okay. Like I think I could absolutely act that, but there's someone out there I bet who fits that and is super talented and can take that role. Right. So it's kind of like the balance of like, but also I want a job. Do you know what I mean?
I agree. And even comes back to like sensitivity. Like for example, I've played Mexican. I played everything but Colombian. I played Polish. I played Italian. I played Mexican. I played Puerto Rican. I played them all, but I say I'm ready to play them. And yet at the same time, I'm conscious of, you know, we're being very sensitive to the, I think the entertainment industry is attempting to be more aware of and sensitive. And in doing so, isolating people who could actually play.
More aware of or sensitive. It's trying to be politically correct.
My point is like
bigger errors and being politically correct.
So like, even now, like if I were to go, it's also a depiction of how they see someone. I don't see myself as, you know, I'm not Menudo by any chance. I don't come off like I'm not Enrique Iglesias or you know what I'm saying? Like Ricky Martin. I've come off like I've lived life a little bit. And so it depends on the project, but my point is, you know what I'm saying? So what I've noticed is, it's how they want to present people. So even when I go in for Puerto Rican and Dominican, and when you see how they cast it, you go, oh, wow. Like they're really identifying how they want Latino to look or whatnot. They can't really open the grasp their minds, which is fine. That being said, you create your own work. That's what we do. And also things come and go and you do what you got to do.
And that's what Tanya's doing.
I'm not too worried about it.
A new equation for switching on outcomes is here from PwC. It's human-led and tech-powered. It's PwC with Oracle, SAP, Salesforce, and Workday. It's PwC with Microsoft, AWS, and Google. Simplify your systems and amplify your results. Switch on outcomes with PwC and their alliances. Learn more at pwc.com.
At Jiffy Lube, we care about cars. In fact, we're kind of obsessed. It's why for over 40 years, we have been providing quick and quality service. And with free instant estimates at jiffylube.com, you can know what to expect, even before your visit. Visit your local Jiffy Lube. We'll car for your car like we car for our own. Jiffy Lube. Car more. Visit jiffylube.com to find coupons and start an instant online estimate.
The West Side Story this year was so beautiful to me because everybody on that stage was, you know, different shades of brown and black and beige, right. And they came from all over the world. Mm-hmm. And it was not a white black story anymore. It was like an American versus immigrant story, but everybody looked exactly the same. It sort of reminded me of the battle between Israelis and Arabs. They look alike. You're the same people. Yeah. You have the same DNA and you're hating each other. I'm here in Seoul, Korea right now. And there's racism here, even between the Asian people. And it's like, you know, how do we have so much more love for our hate than for our humanity?
There's two things.
I have two things I want to say before I lose it. Number one, I feel like, how can, as an American, what we do see is that, you know, as you say, the people in power want to create products. And when they create products, one thing I've recognized and I feel for those who have immigrated, especially, that's why I'm a big fanatic and supporter of John Leguizamo, because he makes it very clear that, you know, the indigenous and the sort of Latinx makeup, we're not existent in the culture that they're telling the stories about. So what I mean by that is, say they come out with some musical about a famous artist, and there is none for the Latinx. There's no one they're going to tell a story about that America can identify to. Selena's coming out on Netflix. That's about it. La Bamba, you might have seen the movie. There's nothing. What I'm saying is, it's not even in the makeup. So Latinx don't even know who to identify with, if not displayed by whatever the American pop culture is displaying, which is generally a caricature or a stereotype. So I'd be remiss to not say that, because one would say, okay, we're pointing out all the things, and yet we're not being aware of all the minor things that hit us every day. It's an everyday thing that you go, oh, wow, we're literally not in the makeup. I don't even see myself.
But if you're not in the makeup,
people are responding to me.
The Asians are even less in the makeup.
And that, let's pop it over to Telly. You know, how do you feel like, you know, your experience has been different in being American? You know, like what is being American to you?
Sure. So I grew up in New York City. I have immigrant parents. My mom and dad, they actually grew up in Guangzhou, China, which is in communist China during the 60s, during Mao. And they actually escaped communism by swimming to Hong Kong, which was 7 hours, by the water. And they tell the story to me like it's like, you know, that's like, well, that's what everybody did, you know, because if you stayed in China where you didn't have an education, there was no opportunity. So everybody just took the risk. They jumped in the water and they tried to escape. So both my parents made the swim. They got to Hong Kong, which at the time did not belong to China. It was a British Commonwealth at the time. So they were political refugees and they met in China. They dated and they knew that they wanted to come to America. They came to New York City because this is where the work was in the 70s for them. My dad worked in Chinese restaurants. My mom was a seamstress. So blue collar parents. And I grew up in Brooklyn. So that was sort of my upbringing. And it's interesting, you know, when you talk about being othered from a very young age, you know, I think every person of color who grew up in America or is a child of an immigrant has this conversation with their parents, but they pull you aside and they go, so you live in America. And I know that in school, when you say the Pledge of Allegiance and you learn about what it is to be an American, it says liberty and justice for all, but you don't look American. And we are not from here. So even though you're born here and you are American and this is your country, you look a certain way and people will judge you by the skin color that is on you. And it doesn't matter if you grew up in Brooklyn and you're the most New York kid ever. That's not what they know. They're going to judge you by your skin. Just so you know, you have to know that going through life. That might mean you have to work harder. That might mean you have to not always speak up all the time. That might mean, and this is a conversation. This might mean that, you know, that things are not always fair to you. And that, you know, so as a little kid, I had this conversation with my parents, right? So, and so growing up, that's sort of like in my DNA now. I think that's in the DNA of a lot of Asian kids who grew up in America. And I don't think we are seen so much, because so much of, you know, the Asian history in America, from us coming here, building railroads, Chinese Exclusion Act, Japanese internment, all of that has been about, how do we not stay active and political? How do we just make sure that we can, you know, make enough money to keep our business, feed our kids, raise our families, not make waves, not cause trouble? That's sort of been, and now I'm happy to say, I think that's turning. I'm happy to say that's also turning with this election. But not my generation, me, I just turned 40 this year. My generation still has that. That's still in my DNA to think that way sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, and when I tell my Caucasian friends that, they go, oh, my parents never had that conversation with me. And I was like, right. So that's what it means to be othered, because your parents never had to have that conversation with you. My parents had to have it since I was a little kid. It's the same conversation that my Black friends have when they go, okay, when you get pulled over, this is how you act, mm-hmm. right? It's mm-hmm. It's that same conversation. It's just, you know, to me, when people ask me, how does that feel to be othered? That's sort of the way I can describe it, in a way where my Caucasian brothers and sisters can understand it.
Sure, like, sure.
Oh, you know that, oh, right. That conversation was never had with me. And I said, well, I think that's what it means to be othered. Same thing being a gay person too. You know, being gay it's the same, you know, that I don't have to think about, you know, you don't have to, my straight friends don't have to think about holding hands in public. I do, depending on where I am. I do have to think about that. That extra step is the other.
Right. The extra step that you have to take to think about what's going to keep me safe every time I walk out. And there's lots of extra steps. You know, Kimberly Crenshaw, in talking about intersectionality, says that human normal in Western capitalism is white, hetero, Christian. And every step away from white, hetero, Christian is another intersection in which you can be discriminated against. So you go, you're gay, that's one. But then if you're gay and you're Jewish, that's two levels of discrimination. And then you're gay and you're Jewish and you're a non-white, now you got another. And so the layers and layers and ways in which people get othered, and the layers of ways in which you don't get the same access or rights, or you have to think about all these extra things to just make it through the day, are compounded by this idea of some kind of human normal that doesn't match the majority of people on the planet.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, that idea of dual consciousness, right? Or just triple, quadruple consciousness, right? All the different layers that you have to be aware of all the time, right?
Have to say, you know, now that we're having these conversations, which I think it's great in 2020 that we're having these conversations, I tell my, you know, my white friends when I have these conversations, it's not like it's a bad thing. You know, it's not bad to be white. Like, I know sometimes you might feel that there is all of that. There's this conversation might make you feel bad or might make you feel uncomfortable. I just said, it's just that that is the way the world has been built. And in a way,
I'll stop you. I'm stopping you right there, Telly, because you're trying to help some people feel better who've made a lot of people feel bad for a really, really long time. Are you married to someone white?
I am married to someone white.
So what's that like right now in this moment?
We have a lot of these conversations, you know, like I remember actually a theatrical experience. We went to go see Slave Play together on Broadway, and we walked away with very different reactions to that play. And it caused a lot of continued conversation between us, even before the pandemic, before George Floyd, that play, sitting in that play together. You know, and whenever we see theater together, we hold hands, right? like we hold hands. And all of a sudden in the middle of that play, I felt this happen. We stopped holding hands. And we just had very different reactions to it. I heard a different story than he heard. And it began this conversation. It's helped me in a way have this conversation with my Caucasian friends and my husband, who is Caucasian, and people that I love who are Caucasian, in a way that helps them understand it without feeling attacked. And I do and feel that is important.
What is this conversation? You keep talking about this conversation. What is the conversation you had to have?
That my experience as an othered person is something you have never had to live with or understand. And that is not a good thing or a bad thing. It's just a different experience.
Who did you identify with in slave play?
Pardon?
Who did you identify with in slave play?
I mean, it's interesting. I think I identified with as an actor, I feel like I sort of like identify with all of them, right? Like in a way, I try to find empathy and compassion with all characters. When I watch a play, I don't really pick a side. And I think that's my training as an actor. We don't pick sides. We don't judge our characters when we play them, right? So like you receive it and you hear it, you know? But like, I just know that his level of discomfort watching that play was very high. My level of recognition of that experience was, I felt like, they're saying this thing that has been so hard for me to say, mm-hmm. right? And like, they're saying it in a play. And there was like my reaction to it was this. And I think his reaction was like, I didn't know, you know?
So, right. But I think what's interesting about, you know, what you were saying just about the discomfort opened up the possibility for a conversation in a new way, right? It's finding the balance, I guess. I don't know who it falls to find that balance, right? But, you know, any person can get defensive. Any person, when they feel attacked, which certain people feel attacked at different times, depending on what the thing is, right? It's a sliding scale for everybody. But when anybody feels attacked, they want to survive. They want to put up their walls. They want to get defensive. They don't hear things. It's all about their perception then, you know, that's a practice thing that we all do to varying degrees. It's like, how do we, and this year I think has been a really interesting, you know, intersection of like people getting uncomfortable and learning from it, people getting uncomfortable and shutting down, you know, like we're seeing all of the different reactions to it. But the discomfort, I feel like, is maybe the best thing that has happened over the last couple of years, and especially in this year, because getting outside of our comfort zone and our normal, then we are forced to confront things. We are forced to start having awkward conversations. We are forced to, you know, to start having these kinds of things. So as much as like, you know, we don't want our friends to feel like they're being attacked or whatever, right? We also recognize that the discomfort also has to exist. Otherwise, we're just going to keep going as status quo, right?
Well, I'm going to say, you know, I want my friends to feel attacked. I want them to feel comfortable. I want them to move into the disease. I want them to feel like, you know, there was at a certain point I wrote something to someone and they were like, wow, that really hurt. It was like, you know, it hurt. And I was like, uh-huh. And I could feel them wanting me to make it better for them. And I was like, mm-hmm. yeah, that's how I feel every day. Well, it's awful. Mm. You shouldn't have to feel that way. And I'm like, but I do feel that way. And I don't feel like I shouldn't have to feel that way, because not only do I hurt, lots of other people hurt. I don't have, it's hurt comes to everybody. That one group of people have set up the world so that they get to avoid most of the hurt by putting it on other people. Yes, you should bear some hurt. Hurt is part of life. Life is good, it's bad, and you should bear some of it too. So I don't feel bad that I'm the gift of bringing it to you. I feel like I am a gift to you, because as you expand your capacity to have these big sensations, then you will expand your humanity. And as long as you stay in an avoidance of this feeling, what you call bad, you are allowed to deny humanity. You're allowed to deny the existence of other people's experience. And you're allowed to continue to perpetrate these delusions and this frauds that are destroying the entire planet.
Right, right. And this actually is, I think, a great stepping off point for us to talk about cancel culture.
Hi, I'm Tanya Pinkins. You're listening to Spotlight, the Red Pilling of America on the Marissa Lynn Daniels Studio, my conversation with actors John Rua and Telly Leung. Come back for part two of You Can't Say That on the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.